And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper here with Bonnie Berman. In her memoir, Blue Plate Special, Kate Christensen writes about the impact food has had on her life. She had a difficult upbringing. Her father was an abusive man who turned his back on his family. But her mother was strong-willed. She never let her daughters go hungry. She whipped up tasty dishes from a simple budget, a lesson Christensen carried with her throughout her own ups and downs. Christensen is the author of 6 novels, including The Great Man. Blue Plate Special follows her evolution as a writer, from her unhappy years at the Iowa Writers' Workshop to her late blooming success. But this is also the story of her many travels and love affairs. A bright, talented woman, Christensen was determined to stuff herself with experience, even at the cost of making herself sick. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Christensen. He began by asking her why food is often associated with sex.
Well, first of all, they're both extremely pleasurable experiences, eating and having sex. And they both involve a lot of the senses. And I think there's something very primal, too, about eating that is also sexual. And, of course, food and sex are two completely different things. But their association is so, I think, at the very base of human experience, the desire to eat, the desire to procreate, the desire to have pleasure. They're both communal experiences, you could say, and they're both sensual, and they both only last so long, and then it's over. A meal, a sexual encounter, and so it's a brief, intense burst of pleasure, and then you can look forward to the next one. And so it's very tied in, I think, with memory and anticipation, both of them.
Well, in your memoir, there's a lot about food and sex, but let's get to the food first. What made you want to write this memoir?
I think that I've wanted all my life to write this book. And part of it is the association with language, memory, and food for me. And starting as a little girl, when I first started writing stories, I wanted to write about food. And my first written story, which I write about in Blue Plate Special, was when I was 7 or 6. And it was called My Magic Carpet Ride. And it was about 2 sisters, little girls, who go around the world on a magic carpet, because I was 6 or 7, and eat in various countries. That's the plot of my first story, is this trip around the world, eating rice in China and eating bread in France. And I don't even know how I knew about these things, but I did. And then they get home in time for tea, which is the happiest ending I could come up with. And so it's inextricably connected for me, food and writing. And when I started writing novels later, I crammed them full of food. And as I've written 6, and I think food plays an essential part in all of them, in one way or another. And so this book is sort of a response to the other food life books I've read by M.F.K. Fisher and Laurie Colwin in particular, but also Nicholas Freeling, who's not well known enough, I don't think, but who is a great food writer, and wrote The Kitchen Book and The Cookbook. And I wanted to write a book that, like those books, treated the intersection of life and food, which to me is exciting and comforting as a reader. And I was feeling as a writer that it was something I wanted to explore, but I had to wait until I was old enough and had a story to tell.
The last sentence of your memoir is you're wishing happy birthday to your father. And after reading your memoir, your father was very complicated.
Yes.
Abusive.
Yes.
He beat your mother in front of you when you were a child. Had other children with another family that he didn't seem to be interested in. Eventually abandoned you, or just turned his back on you and your sisters. You haven't seen him in a while, have you?
I haven't seen him since I was 27, and now I'm almost 51. So almost half my life. The last time I saw him, I didn't know it was the last time. We had a perfectly pleasant dinner in the Bay Area. I was there during graduate school, visiting a boyfriend, and he was living in San Francisco, and he took me out to dinner, and we said goodbye, and then I never saw him again. But that's very in keeping with my father. I've heard from him over the years. He read my first novel and wrote me an email, which came out of the blue and which startled and surprised me. But my feelings about my father through the writing of this book have ceased to be complicated and have become very simple. I just realized He hasn't been part of my life really ever, except in these intense, powerful ways that you just described, violent, distant, and disappearing, and deadbeat. Because he stopped paying child support when he disappeared when I was 10 or 11. And then we were really poor. We were poor before, but then we were really poor. And so I don't have fond memories of him. But what I have are the memories of a little girl who only knew one father. And he was also very charismatic, and he was very intelligent, and he sang songs. And he was a hero to a lot of people in the Bay Area in the 60s. He was a Marxist lawyer who worked pro bono for draft dodgers, Black Panthers, conscientious objectors, the rabble-rousers. And so it wasn't so simple for me for many years. But saying goodbye to my father, which I do at the end of the book, felt great. It felt like a necessary thing, and it was time.
We're speaking with Kate Christensen, whose latest book is a memoir entitled Blue Plate Special. Your mother and your sisters, they play a big role in this memoir. Your mother is a fascinating figure, a real survivor, very strong-willed, but there's a wistful quality to her because she's had a very rough life. And so has, well, at least one of your sisters, who belonged to a Christian cult for many years. And you talk about all of them very candidly, as well as yourself. How have they responded to your memoir?
I sent them the first draft, which was a 300-page chronology of my own life. And I wanted them to corroborate and help me because I was hazy on some of the details. But I also wanted to have that conversation with them about the past, which is exactly what happened. And we rehashed in a round robin of emails because they live in New Zealand, Amsterdam, and Arizona, and I live in Maine. So we're all in different time zones and on different continents. So it happened in emails. And we talked about the past and directly addressed all the things in the book for the first time ever. My sister recently came out of the 12 tribes, which is the the Christian cult that she was living in with her family intact. So my sister Emily, and she recently returned to the family. So it was really our first chance as a family. And this book was it was the instigator of this conversation. And so I'm glad I wrote it, if only for that, because we ended up realizing that my sisters and I all had radically different childhoods. And we almost had different parents. Which I think is true in a lot of families, that the experience is so different depending on your birth order and your perspective and your own sort of personality. But we ended up, my mother and sister are coming to Maine next week. I'm having a book launch in the town where I live, Portland, Maine, and they're going to be there for it, which is, it's my mother's birthday. And so it's this, I feel like they're celebrating it now. And we had a hard time. We struggled with it, my mother especially, because I talk so much about her difficulties and her incredibly hard, painful, lonely childhood, and then her difficult marriages, and this period in her life where she had a nervous breakdown, I think in response to having to always be so strong and always take such good care of us, which she did, when we hit adolescence and didn't need her as much anymore. I think that was the first time in her life when she could really just fall apart, and she did. And I wrote about that, but not without empathy. I completely understand, and I write about the time when I was angry at her.
Because you've fallen apart a couple of times.
Absolutely, and I feel like my life has followed the trajectory of hers in ways that I did everything to avoid. I mean, it's like it's the Oedipal thing. You can't avoid your fate.
Well, mentioning Oedipal, you know, going back to your dad, you did identify with your father. You mentioned in the book that you try to be more masculine. What do you mean by that?
Well, in that initial scene that I start the book with, that horrific soft-boiled egg breakfast and domestic violence, and I still love soft-boiled eggs, by the way. It did not ruin my love for them. I watched that happen, and I loved my parents, and I was their firstborn, so I had them all to myself for a couple of years. And watching that happen, I felt myself split in two. And I distinctly remember the feeling, like I wanted to be a guy. I didn't want to be like my mother then. If being vulnerable and female and needy, which which had provoked his rage, her asking him to stay and help clean up breakfast. She had two little kids under two, had provoked this violence. I thought, well, then I better not be like that ever. And so my identification with my father was self-protective, and it ultimately was my undoing in my 40s when it all kind of, my life fell apart completely. My marriage fell apart. I fell apart. And I revisited that scene viscerally and had a panic attack so severe, my ex-husband had to call the paramedics. I mean, I thought I was having a heart attack. And it's because I had never fully inhabited myself in that scene watching that happen. I just removed myself and tried to be like a guy for the rest of my life.
But it did inform your relationships with men.
Yeah.
I mean, because, again, you're very candid about that in the memoir. And I don't want to put you down. I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you. But, you know, you went out with a bunch of...
Go ahead, say it.
Scumbags.
Well, you know, I made some questionable romantic choices. Yeah. But my husband was a really nice guy. He was a deeply, deeply good, and still is, although we're not together anymore. And so I feel like I made a good choice in the guy I married anyway. And now I'm fine.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with author Kate Christensen. I'm Aaron Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Aaron Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Kate Christensen. Kate is the author of 6 novels, but her latest book is a memoir entitled Blue Plate Special. Kate, you touch on your writing career in this memoir. You're a late bloomer. You didn't publish your first novel until you were in your late 30s.
That's right.
And you didn't achieve recognition until 2006. When you won the Penn Faulkner Award.
Actually, it was 2008.
Or was it 2008?
Yeah, I think I was, how old was I then? 46, wasn't I?
You're mid-40s.
I was in my mid-40s, yeah.
Because that novel, The Great Man, won the prestigious Penn Faulkner Award and put you on the map, so to speak. You attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I like that chapter because every person I've ever interviewed who went to Iowa always has something bad to say about it, especially if it's a female. I remember I interviewed one writer who shall remain nameless, who said that at Iowa, they have teachers who don't write anymore teach about writing. Is that the case when you went to Iowa?
It's arguable that Frank Conroy wasn't writing. All right, I'll just go out on a limb. Yeah, I don't think Frank Conroy was really writing anymore. He published a novel later after I left about jazz. I can't remember what it was called, some jazzy title. But I think he was really frustrated, and I think that informed the way he ran the workshop. And I think that the fact that his first book was a small coming-of-age memoir, Stop Time, which is a really good book, caused him to belittle anyone else who was writing a small coming-of-age novel. And that happened to include me and most of the women in the workshop because we were all in our 20s, and what else were we really going to write at that age? For most of us, I think it was a sort of time of autobiographical earnestness.
But you say that Iowa, or the Iowa's Writers' Workshop, is very cliquish, very competitive.
It was, yeah.
Did you feel, so it wasn't an environment that was conducive to nurturing the writer?
No. In fact, I just saw my friend Gretchen, who's in the book, I just saw her last night in Chicago, and we were joking about it, how cold the writer's workshop was and how great it was to have good friends there and allies, and how sort of lonely it could have been if we hadn't found each other. She was a poet at the time. But the irony is that I'm about to go and teach there in the fall.
Really?
Yeah. I'm going to go teach a fiction workshop and a seminar starting at the end of August. And so I'm looking at you thinking, oh no, is this the kiss of death? And will I never write again? But I don't know if that's the case. I mean, Marilyn Robinson is there and she's certainly continuing.
Yeah, she came out of Gilead 25 years after Housekeeping. And James Allen McPherson, another teacher that published his last book 35 years ago, but I'm not going to criticize them. But but I'm glad you're teaching there. That's a ray of sunlight.
Thank you.
But you do have praise for one teacher, Alan Gurganis.
I love Alan.
And Alan Gurganis, for people who don't know, I admire him as well, is a Southern writer, a gay Southern writer, who achieved, was a late bloomer like you, achieved success, you know, fairly later in life with his best-selling book, The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. What made him stand out for you?
First of all, he would come into workshop just ebullient and excited to be there and full of stories and full of energy and full of just, you know, the desire to teach. I think that he's a natural teacher as well as an incredibly brilliant writer. Plays Well with Others and White People are two of my favorite books ever written. And I think Alan is brilliant. And I think he loved teaching. And I think he loves storytelling and language and all the old-fashioned things. And this is, like, we're talking the late 80s when it was kind of a very kind of conceptual, cerebral era and or minimalistic, and he is none of those things. He encouraged us. He was tough. He did not hold our hands or mollycoddle us, but he really encouraged real writing. I feel like maybe it's because he's from the South or because he's a real writer. I mean, or both. But his excitement. Oh, and every week he wore a different tie, and so it was fun to watch him come in and see what kind of tie he was wearing. But he took a real interest in his students in a way that was unusual at Iowa at the time. I understand Iowa has changed a lot.
The director's now a woman.
Yes, now that the director's a woman. I think that the rampant sexism that I experienced and the boys network and all of that is no more.
We're speaking with Kate Christensen, whose latest book is a memoir entitled Blue Plate Special. Of all your novels that I've read, the one that I admire most is The Epicure's Lament. This novel was written under unusual circumstances. It was 9/11 inspired it. How so?
After September 11th, I was in love with New York, and the book that I wrote before The Epicure's Lament was Jeremy Thrain, which was kind of my love song to New York, as well as highly autobiographical about me as a gay man, actually. I put myself in the narrative voice of a gay man. And my love for New York was this golden era in the city, and it was a great time to be there in the late 90s. There was kind of a feeling of excitement in New York. And then September 11th happened, and the city changed and has never been the same since in so many ways that have been talked about and documented. And a lot of us, me included, fell into a severe depression. I mean, I couldn't get out of bed. I was crying all day. I just was seized with panic and fear that it would happen again. And then I started writing a very earnest novel about a group of people upstate. And it was centered on the marriage of Dennis and Marie, who were two of the characters in The Epicure's Lament. And I was trying to make it like Middlemarch. I was trying to make it just great. And I wanted to write something ambitious and deep and like the big social realist novel. And I got so bored with it. And I was so depressed anyway. And this novel was just making me fall asleep at my computer. And then Hugo walked in, Dennis's brother, just with his attitude, snarling, just sort of wet-haired, smoking, limping. And I thought, who is this guy? He took over the novel. He hijacked it. And his sort of anger was really my anger, was the anger that was causing my depression because it was imploding. And Hugo allowed me to make it external and to give it voice and shape. And the rage that I felt after September 11th about what was happening to this country and what had happened to the city that I was so in love with, I moved it all upstate, and I put it all in the voice of a cantankerous 40-year-old hermit who's smoking himself to death on the Hudson River in a mansion, cooking and making trouble. And he just he saved me. Writing that book really saved me.
One thing I hear from young male writers who are just starting out, they have difficulty assuming a female voice. You don't have that problem with assuming a male voice. As you said, Jeremy Thrain, Game Epistle, it's a male voice, obviously. And Hugo, definitely the male voice. Why do some male writers have difficulty with, you know, assuming a female persona?
Maybe they aren't in touch with their girly side enough. Because I feel like my male voices come directly from my own identification with the male side of myself that started when I was 2 and when I decided I was going to be a guy and I didn't want to be a girl. And so that's really different now. And now I feel fully integrated for the first time just in the last few years, which enables me to talk about it even and to realize what was going on. But I had so much fun assuming a male voice because I felt like I was free. I was free writing Hugo's voice to say what I really thought and to say things that weren't politically correct and to be angry and to be sort of aggressive. And in a female voice, I hadn't learned to express all that. And I think that is the really interesting thing, to own a female voice for me. And why some male writers can't do it, I have no idea. But it's exciting when somebody can.
You're in a happy place now, in part because you're with someone that you can be happy with. But this is someone who's much younger than you. And the only reason I bring that up is because many men, older men, go out with younger women and people accept that. But when an older woman goes out with a younger man, there is some sort of stigma attached to that. Why is that?
I don't know. When we first got together, I felt the stigma. I was freaked out by what people would think. He was 27 and I was 46 when we got together. And we fell madly in love and recognized that we were soulmates and that when we were alone together, the age difference didn't exist, really. It fell away and we were equals. But among people I knew, it wasn't so simple, to put it mildly.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Kay Christensen.